This is KPW 97.3 LPFM, Eugene Community Radio, and you're listening to Water is Life, a place where we bring together conversations about our love for water and all the different ways that we give love, honor, and respect to the water element, as well as the need to protect it. I'm Ocean Song, and my co-host here with me is John Abbey, and we have two guests, both Hafez Leland and Ada Ball. Hafez Leland is a Sufi leader in our Eugene community and the board president of the Interfaith Prayer Service in Eugene. Ada Ball here with us is a community member from the Siletz and Klamath tribes, so she's an indigenous woman local to the tribes of our area, and she's a water protector. She's been involved with the work to protect the water and the effort to stop the pipeline that they're attempting to put through Oregon again. And also, she's been at Standing Rock. So we're excited to hear from her. I'm excited to talk with the two of you, and I'm excited to talk about water. And we're going to start by hearing from Hafez and talk more about his involvement with the water element and the way it's used in the Sufi tradition. A lot of people are only aware of kind of the one way that they're used to relating to water. And so I thought about the Sufi community and how you guys are kind of connected in all these beautiful ways with different cultures and different ways that people have used that water in those special ways.
Right. Well, I know, you know, Sufis in a nutshell, you know, many of us study and try and work with as many practices as we can. This is as a generalization, but for myself, I've been studying Buddhism for about 40 years or more, and I know what I've read is that some Buddhists, you know, every drop of water that they use is precious, and so like the bowl that you eat out of, some Buddhists will pour a small amount of water into that bowl to rinse the bowl, and they will drink even that water, you know. So it's not like we go to the sink and wash our dish and you know, there goes a whole lot of water and we don't even think about it. You know, and I'm sure there's many, many different traditions, native traditions and Christian traditions, like probably all the traditions have. I asked a rabbi actually recently, and he said basically only once a year do they do a ritual for the water, by the water. But others, you know, on a daily basis or something close to that will pray for the water. And you know, as many of you know, we have one of the 13 indigenous grandmothers right here in Oregon who has prayed for the water right here, like within a mile of where we're sitting. And and that has inspired me to almost every time I go to the river or go to the ocean or blessed by being by a lake, I try and think about that and send, you know. Because, you know, the obvious thing that most of you know is that we're almost 70% water. And so by blessing the water, we're blessing all that runs through our bodies, you know. You know, that alone can be a step towards health and healing, to come in balance with the earth, to come in balance with the water, with the fire, with the air, you know. And it's not without saying that we're at such a time here in the Northwest, in North America now, where you know, North America's on fire, and it's been challenging for me breathing the smoke every day, even trying to get out of the valley. There's still smoke even out of the valley, and you know, that's a tough thing. So that's like, where do we find the balance between the water, all the elements, while you know, while the smoke and places are burning, you know, not that far away from us? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd love to know.
Yeah. Well, water seems to be key when it comes to balancing that fire energy. The first thing I think is, yeah, the water is, I mean, when I think about the Northwest, one of the first things that comes to mind is how lucky we are to have the beautiful water that we have here, and just deep appreciation for that being a part of my whole life. I was born in the mountains just above Eugene here, and I lived on the ocean until I moved to Alaska, which also has a lot of very beautiful water. And then I came back here when I was about 30. So I've been pretty spoiled in that way, and just recognizing that everybody in the world is as blessed as we are here, to fully understand and appreciate that is one thing that I've tried really hard in my life to do.
I grew up on the East Coast, and I didn't realize until I moved out west how much I oriented my geography from where the ocean was. The water was east. And so when I moved west, I kept getting east and west mixed up because I just, my assumed water was to the east. I noticed that when Hafez started talking about Native traditions, you were nodding your head, Ada, and I was wondering if you wanted to throw anything in there or anything else.
Well, I'm not like a medicine person or anything like that. I'm just your average kind of community member from the Tsleil-Waututh in Klamath tribes here in Oregon. My nations are Khahusadi, Dakobedede, Modoc, Klamath. And yeah, I think I can really just only affirm the work that Grandma Aggie Pilgrim has done in the Pacific Northwest to advocate for water.
Is that the grandmother
water.
You were that yeah. you was talking about?
Uh-huh. Yeah, she's also from the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh, which is where I am enrolled. And she is just a badass Tekelma grandma,
you know. Definitely.
Just representing, you know, I think what it means to be an Indigenous woman advocating for the water and reminding people of, like, that, you know, we do have this relationship with water and that it's also a responsibility that depends on reciprocity. Mm. And that the water that we are fortunate to have access to, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, is pristine and the way it is because of the Indigenous people of those places taking care of it and having that relationship with the water. Mm. And how that might be a little bit out of balance now, but yeah, I think that's all I should say. I just came to talk about pipelines.
Well, it's all related. That's kind of the point of the show.
Yeah, definitely.
And when you said about taking responsibility, it really struck me because I really appreciated it, Hafez, when you said some of what you said at the beginning. You talked about it in terms of what people can do. You know, oh, you can take the water in your hands. And I'm really hoping that both parts of our show offer people what they can do, how they can get involved, because we are all responsible. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Very true, very true. I was blessed to get to be a part of a couple different things that Grandma Aggie was at, and I really enjoyed every single time listening to her speak and the way she expresses how important it is to take that space with the water and understand and appreciate it. And I'm sure that it's played a part in probably even what inspired this show, you know, is... It's funny how we touch each other's lives like that, and she probably would not ever guess that she helped inspire this show, but there
Thanks,
you go.
Grandma.
Exactly. That's exactly. Awesome. So I definitely thought about the Sufi community because of the way there's that intentional effort to learn about the different ways of different cultures and the different ways that everybody honors creator and honors those elements, including water. And so I really enjoyed listening to the different perspectives that you had. I never thought about that, putting sound into the water. I hadn't actually thought about that. One of the Native elders that I am blessed to have in my life is from an Ojibwe family, and she every morning when she takes her first drink of water, she talks about how to do it with consciousness and to think about how blessed we are to have that moment and to give that love back to the water as she gives her love to you, you know. And so I just love all the different ways that water is appreciated like that. Is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to share in that way?
Well, talking about those first moments of the day, you know, I heard someone reflecting on this, who I think learned this from one of the other 13 grandmothers, that when you first go outside, first thing in the morning, whatever time that is, that you really take in and appreciate the light of the morning. Whatever time of day that is, you know, some of us get up at 6, others, the sun's been up for a long time, to either raise up your hands or just to look into the light in the east and be blessed by the by this. You're here for another day, like Brother David Stendelrast has talked about. You know, we're here for a reason, and we're here like to be blessed by the day, the sun and the earth and all the elements. So I try to do that. I've had a practice for a long time, and this is not really related to my Sufi path, of going outside as early as I can, often barefoot, you know, and just to, even if I step onto concrete first, but then I'm blessed with grass that I can walk on, and just to look at the trees and look at the sky is a precious thing. Just like, you know, when you get into the shower, are you at all conscious that you're using so many gallons of water? You know, it may or may not be that we can always have enough water for our gardens. And, you know, to me, gardening is like one of the most precious things in life. And so if I were not to have water for a garden, it would be a sad day, because growing food is just is essential to me. So I don't know, for, you know, water and light, and sound, you know, I could just say for a minute, for Sufis, you know, singing and chanting and making sounds is, you know, I've been doing it regularly for over 30 years, and it never ceases to amaze me how if you sing, especially sacred sounds, for any amount of time, it's going to bring healing into your body, and even better, possibly with a group of people, you know, with a certain intention. So taking that sound, whatever your sound is, whether it's a Christian prayer, whether it's a Buddhist prayer, whether it's just the sound, like Sufis sometimes use the sound, hu, and if you put that into your water, it may bring a different vibration to the water. So yeah, I agree, John. I like to think of really practical things that people could do every day if they choose to, if they're aware enough to be conscious of that water. And the thing I've learned from two different teachers, one was a teacher around health and healing, another was a Sufi teacher, this thing about taking your cup or glass and pouring your water or your tea, or could even do with your coffee, it might cool it off. And, you know, just like thinking good thoughts and positive healing energy into that
water.
You're
saying this, and with your hands you're pouring back and forth. That's I know, you talked about that earlier.
And it does make a difference. I do that often with my afternoon tea, and it really seems to make a difference. But I'll keep working at it.
That's beautiful. I love ritual, and in the way to be able to express your love for water or any other thing through rituals is, it's really meaningful to me. It's part of what I think keeps me grounded. So is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation, John? Anybody else that has anything that they're feeling like they wanted to add? I guess I'm excited to kind of use this show to kind of explore the different ways that people connect with water. One of the things is the woman whose song played before as our intro song to the show. She has a lot of different songs about water, and I think music, you know, you're talking about the sound and the way you create energy through that. And I was thinking, I really want to bring her on and ask her, you know, water clearly inspired about 3/4 of the song she plays. So I think that it's like one of those inspiring elements. There's so many songs about water. Hmm. I was looking into, and traditional ones, you don't even, when I think about a water song, I think more of a Native American chant, you know, a drum song that's like a water song in that way. And so when I went online, I was kind of looking for different water songs, and I was like, I hadn't even thought of Sitting on the Dock of the Bay is kind of a water song. So it's like, well,
surf music.
There's so many different ways people connect with water and music, both spiritually and also in a lot of other ways, I think. Musicians connect with that water energy through their song.
Yeah, actually, lately I've been listening to a CD that just came back to me. I hadn't listened to it for years, and it was a tribute to Rachel Carson, one of the great environmentalists of the 20th century. And if you don't know anything about Rachel Carson, look her up. Mm-hmm. She was quite a hero to people like Pete Seeger and to many others. And so there was a tribute to her with many great folk singers, and at least half the songs on that CD are about water. Some beautiful songs about water. And so that came back around. I do have a short poem about water.
That would be great.
Because for people who know nothing about the Sufi path, they may know about Sufi poetry, because the best-selling poet in American history is Rumi, which I don't have any Rumi, but I do have, this book called Water, Wind, Earth, and Fire. And it has, I was actually looking at it while I was sitting by Cottage Grove Lake a week ago, and it was 102 or something. And this is a quote from Rainer Maria Rilke, a German poet, and it is short, but it says a lot. May what I do flow from me like a river, no forcing and no holding back, the way it is with children. Then in these swelling and ebbing currents, these deepening tides moving out, returning, I will sing you as no one ever has, streaming through widening channels into the open sea. The water can be so healing. Just to be at the ocean, I've been thinking ever since this heat wave started, I think every day about going to the ocean, and I haven't been since February, I don't think. And, you know, just to be by the ocean for any amount of time, even for an hour, it just, like, clears the mind and clears the smoke out of our lungs, God willing.
So true. I actually maybe we'll use this as a bit of a segue into the next part of the show, where, I met John at Occupy Eugene, and that was kind of my initial getting involved in activism in a really serious way. Like, I participated in some different things, some anti-nuclear kind of things, and but that was kind of when I really got involved. And I was one of the last people that left the camp because my interest was in documenting things, and there was a vet there that didn't leave until the very end. And so I stayed there with my camera with him, and it was Christmas Eve, and I have a very large family, so it was kind of, a very tugging moment, and intentionally so, I think, from the powers that be. But and so there was a point when he decided to leave. And when I left, I just had so much going on, I took it to the ocean. That's always been my way of being able to release things, because I had this thing go on, which I thought, maybe this is like what a post-stress disorder feels like, because I was dreaming for the days after that happened. I dreamt and dreamt so heavily. I was waking up exhausted and feeling just like completely wiped. And when I took it to the ocean and gave it back, she just took it away. I actually wrote a song, my only song I've ever written, about taking my prayers out with the tide, And so it's been a way that I've been able to release things. And and over the years since then, too, it's become my habitual way of releasing. Like, when things become like, oh, all of these things is just so much, like what happened at Standing Rock, and these things that, can be pretty overwhelming. And so it's wonderful that that ocean water, for me, steps up and helps cleanse that and gives me a clean slate to come back to the table with. So we're gonna break for the rest of this song and play it for a moment while John puts together a news segment. He's gonna share some local news, some news about DAPL, and maybe a little
and
world news
national,
and,
yep.
And world news. And so, here's Alice.
I was baptized as a little child. They took me into the church to save my soul. And the priest prayed to his God above as he dipped my little body in that water bowl. Oh, 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 I'm made out of water. Water is the only thing can quench my thirst. And I'm always trying to get back to the water from that very first breath on my day of birth. I found myself on an island. I dove into the ocean, so warm and sweet. And the songs came and shook me to my spirit, like the big waves crashing on that white sand beach. Then you came and took me down to the river, helped me get into a little red boat, and held my hand, said, baby, flip on over. Oh, the goddess loves the rhythm of this rock and roll. Oh, 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 I'm made out of water. Water is the only thing can quench my thirst. And I'm always trying to get back to the water from that very first breath on my day of birth. Rushing rhythm of a beautiful snow-fed mountain creek, and I pray each day to gain a little wisdom as I let the cold water baptize me. I am a woman guided by emotion, dancing to the groove of the ebb and flow, and the moon pulls on me like she pulls on the ocean. I'm her current from my head down to my little toe. Oh, 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 I'm made out of water. Water is the only thing can quench my thirst. And I'm always trying to get back to the water from that very first breath on my day of birth. Oh, 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 I'm made out of water. Water is the only thing can quench my thirst, and I'm always trying to get back to the water from that very first breath on my day of birth.
Hello. And welcome. This is KEPW 97.3 FM, and you're listening to Water is Life. We're going to have a little news segment now. One thing we didn't really realize until today is it happens to be International Indigenous Peoples Day. So there's a lot of events going all over the place at the UN and many other places around that. Also, the Sundance. Sundance is a very important thing that happens in a lot of, it's a Lakota tradition, I believe, so you're all different. Tribes are doing it. There's one happening right now at Rosebud Sioux Tribe Reservation. Last we heard, Teresa Black Owl, who was on our last episode, is there. And I talked with Eugenian Misha Goldberg, who's there, and talked about that. And she wanted everyone to know that water protectors from Rosebud Camp continue to pray with the Lakota for the integrity of the earth. Rosebud Camp was one of the many camps at Standing Rock, and there were a lot of connections between Eugene and Rosebud. Locally here, I want to let everybody know, who doesn't already, that Cascadia Forest Defenders has initiated a tree sit out near Mackenzie Bridge. They're doing that to stand up against logging on public lands, and specifically to protect the Mackenzie River watershed, which of course suffers every time there's a clear cut, all the erosion and so on. So there's a tree climbing training every Tuesday night at the Campbell Club. I think that's at 5:30, but if you go on Cascadia Forest Defenders on Facebook, you'll find that. We'll have links for a lot of these on the KEPW page up later today, so keep an eye out for that. Also, semi-locally, up in Seattle, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, yesterday even, the same Bakken oil train was blockaded twice in one day. This is the first time I'm aware of that anybody's done that. That's another thing going on. Also, there was a women's silent march yesterday in Tacoma to stop an LNG pipeline that people are trying to put through there with the Puyallup tribe. Somebody correct me if I'm getting that wrong.
Puyallup,
thank you. Going on to General Dakota Access Pipeline news, for all you people who might think it's over and we lost, oh no, no, no. Yes, oil is flowing through the pipeline, but there's still a lawsuit going on where the latest judge's determination was that the Army Corps did not properly go through their environmental review as they were supposed to. And there's some question now legally about whether or not the oil can continue to flow while that's going on. And just today or yesterday, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe filed a brief with the court explaining why it was legally necessary to shut down the pipeline while that lawsuit continues. Also in Iowa, although there was a ruling against the eminent domain lawsuit, ruling that eminent domain used there to allow the Dakota Access Pipeline, that was ruled okay by a court, but that's being appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court, so that also could impact Dakota Access Pipeline down the road. There's also, the Dakota Access Pipeline ends in Illinois. So along with that, they needed expansions of their overall pipeline capacity from there down to the Gulf Coast. So there's a pipeline called the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, which you can kind of think of as DAPL South. And there's a group fighting that. There's a lot of people fighting that down there. And in particular, there's L'eau est la vie, water is life, camp down there. People should look that up. We'll get some links available to you there as well. Hang on a second, got to switch to page 2. Too much. All right. So as you may know, Dakota Access is intended primarily to allow them to do more fracking in the Bakken in North Dakota. And Keystone XL is one of a number of expansions that would allow them to ship more oil out of the Athabascan tar sands up in Alberta, Canada. But there are a bunch of other pipelines as well. And there is a treaty alliance that now more than 100 different First Nations tribes have signed on to stop all 5 of those pipeline expansions, as well as other kinds of tar sands expansion going on. And there's a lot of action going on with those pipelines. I can't even share all of it, but this week the Nebraska Public Service Commission is having hearings on whether a state permit will be given. We know the federal government's going to go along, but the state permit that Nebraska Commission is having hearings right now. You can tune into them live still the next 2 days. And of course, there were big protests and a lot of people there, and people can submit comments still to that. Also, construction has begun on Enbridge Line 3, which is another of these tar sands pipeline. And we know people here in Eugene who are out there. There's a Camp Turtle Island that's just getting started out there has been going for a while. That's ready for when things get hot and heavy there, as well as doing other good things. And we'll have links about that as well. Is that it for news? I think that's it. Wow, got it within 5 minutes. All right, we'll try to give you an update once a month, which is not often enough, but we'll do the best we can. And please send in your things to staff@kepw.org. You can send any news, and we'll try to get it in next month. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So thank you very much. So we're ready to talk more about with Ada Ball about water protection efforts here and Oregon and other places. I think that, were you involved with Standing Rock at all? Did you go up there?
Yeah, I went and visited for a couple weeks back in November. Some friends and I, we heard that there was like a need for a kitchen for the school out there, and so we got together a bunch of kitchen supplies from Eugene and we went out and yeah, we were there, and it was a pretty intense journey. Like, on the way there, my car was totaled by this, like, beast of an elk in Montana, and that was intense, but it was actually pretty powerful in that it brought the group that we were all traveling with together, and we all became pretty good friends because of it, like, you know, trauma bonding or whatever, but social worker kind of joke. But anyway, so yeah, so when we got there, it was also starting to get below freezing temperatures, so things were pretty different in terms of, like, dynamics. There weren't as many direct actions happening, and I think some of the kind of, like, cultural components that were kind of, like, sustaining for a lot of people, the camps, that wasn't so much happening from what I saw. Like, there was drumming the first night that we were there, but then there was a fire and stuff like that, so then the drumming stopped, and I think it was just, like, too cold, and people were really focused on winterizing the camps and stuff like that. But I was really interested in how Native and non-Native folks were kind of interacting with each other in that space. That's something that's always interested me. And so I have, like, traditional Indigenous chin marks. It's like a women's puberty, like, quote unquote, on women's, because that's kind of, like, you know, a colonial English term, but a puberty tattoo that has been practiced in the different Indigenous communities that I'm descended from. And so anyways, when I was at Standing Rock, I would just, like, tie a scarf around my face, and I would just walk around and, like, listen to people and kind of just, you know, listen how people were talking to each other, treating each other, and working with each other. And that was pretty interesting. And I think because the weather was so cold, and because, like, there weren't direct actions happening, there weren't really things for people to plug into, there was kind of, like, tensions. And I don't know. I had the privilege to kind of witness those conflicts, and those are things that happen in any sort of resistance space, and, you know, in resistance spaces that are centered around Indigenous leadership. I really appreciated the opportunity to see that, because then later on, right before I left to come back to the Pacific Northwest, there was the night that the water cannons happened, and we left, like, a couple days after that, and it was incredible to see the shift in the camp, where people they knew what they had to do. Like, the camp just transformed into a completely different, like, operational war zone, defensive space, and everyone had something to do, and everyone was, like, you know, helping and stuff like that for people who were coming back from the front line of that action. So yeah, I don't know. That's kind of my experience in a nutshell. And, is something that I guess I still reflect on, and trying to, be a part of this work with the Jordan Cove Pacific Connector pipeline, liquefied natural gas pipeline. It's proposed to go through Southern Oregon. It would start in Southern Oregon near Tule Lake, well, actually Northern California, and then go over to Coos Bay, and it will go through several traditional Indigenous territories, which are now under the kind of, like, confederacies of the Tsleil-Waututh, the Selkirk Band of Umpqua, the Klamath tribes, the Coos or Umpqua, and Siuslaw, and I think the Coquille as well. And that's not even to mention the other nations that are downriver of this proposed pipeline. The Klamath River alone has a lot of people, and, you know, there's also a lot of non-Native people who would be impacted by this proposed project. I've just, like, kind of been playing catch up with this issue, and trying to figure out how I can be most useful for this issue as a Kahusadi, Dakobe Dede, Modoc Klamath woman. for, you know, the traditional territories that I'm from, but also to the communities that I'm from, and to the non-native communities that are also along this route, this pipeline route.
How did you first find out about it? How did you get involved?
I heard about it like several years ago, but I don't know, like there's just so many issues going on, you know. And when this project was renewed in like January or February of this year, after it was declined again in December of last year, and then with like the current administration, you know, like with Trump and the White House and the different things that are going on around that, and the different controversies that are happening even within the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is like, you know, having a key part in this project right now.
They're the ones who turned it down last time.
Right, right. And they're currently accepting public comments right now.
We'll have a link for that too on
excellent.
The website. But people can go to Rogue Climate and click on events, and they'll get to a way to submit comments. And it's important to give those soon, because that will determine what FERC looks at when they do an environmental review.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Yeah, Rogue Climate is amazing and has been really a leader. Rogue Climate is a nonprofit based out of Southern Oregon. I can talk, I promise. And they have been, you know, working with the non-native private landowners who have been really fierce with this issue the past several years. I've had the privilege to like get to know them. I've like eaten with them and stuff like that, and gone to hear their stories and you know, the development of this project. And what it's been like in their lives. You know, as a Native person and someone, you know, who is like a U.S. citizen who's lived in Oregon their whole lives, it's like kind of just a balance. And I'm sure with people, you know, balancing kind of multiple identities or whatever, like trying to find out how to bring all those together to be the most helpful. It's, you know, do work for yourself, but also for the people around you. So that's kind of been about figuring out how to educate and advocate around this issue. And
And what is it that grabbed you about it? It sounds like you've known about it for a few years, but obviously something has changed so that now this is something you're invested in.
Right. Yeah. So I guess in a nutshell, just like, you know, there have been people in this current like admin who've been on record saying that they want this project to go through. And you know, not gonna lie, just like hearing those kind of like ignorant statements just kind of like, you know, light a fire of rage within you, because it's just these statements are really being made from a place of wanting to like exploit land that is like very meaningful to all sorts of people in Southern Oregon, especially Indigenous people who, you know, are the ancestral like stewards of those places and who have sacred sites and village sites and stuff like that, and relationships with the waterways that are going through there, and who have been doing
hundreds of waterways,
right. Which connect with all over southern western Oregon and northern California, and just like, you know, wanting to show up to, you know, try and be helpful for a lot of this restoration work that Indigenous peoples have been doing. Because this liquefied natural gas pipeline project would definitely be a huge setback. It's a very dangerous project. I was just reading this article the other day about how wildfires and liquefied natural gas pipelines, like, that's a huge, scary thing. It's really about also Indigenous sovereignty. In that these bold statements are being made by people from the top who are so like removed from these communities and these places, and who just want to profit off of what so many people have fought for to protect and to restore, and to just, you know, wanting to support that in any way that I can.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much for your work with that. I mean, I think it's really important, and it's hard to figure out what to do. And I think a lot of people, including myself, I was thinking about, kind of being in a position of knowing virtually nothing about this topic. I really know very little about the pipeline and the potential issues with the watersheds down there. And so in that way, I can kind of be somebody that comes from a layman's perspective and trying to understand what the issues really are. And I guess it only makes sense. We have waterways everywhere, all over this state, and the idea that an issue would travel far and wide very quickly. And I would assume that's one of the biggest problems, but maybe you can share more of the risks that such an action would cause potential problems in our state, maybe?
Yeah, sure. So the pipeline, the proposed JCPC pipeline is a lot different than like the Dakota Access Pipeline or the KXL pipeline, in that liquefied natural gas, when it leaks, because all pipelines leak, it won't be like a slow, oozy kind of leak. It'll be an explosion. And the pipeline where it's going to connect in Northern California is going to be in a predominantly Latinx, Spanish-speaking community. So, you know, that's what we call environmental racism, putting like a very dangerous, large polluter, because it's going to be a huge facility that these pipelines are going to connect at. And it's going to emit just so many, I think, unprecedented levels of toxins into this community. And
yeah, I've heard that when it's done, the plant at the end will become the largest carbon emitter in the state.
Right, in Coos Bay? Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah. And then so it's going to travel all the way through Southern Oregon to Coos Bay and to Coos territory. And yeah, you're going to have this huge facility that is in a tsunami zone. You know, I think you can kind of like think about that. But additionally, this pipeline is connecting and hitting the Rogue River, the Klamath River, which are huge veins in the state of Oregon that support a lot of streams and communities. So liquefied natural gas is very dangerous. And, you know, in a similar way with crude oil pipelines, it's very difficult to clean up when those things spill. Additionally, we have to think about how are we going to clean the air when this thing explodes.
And even if it doesn't explode, the methane in it is like the worst carbon greenhouse gas.
Right, so, right.
Yeah. And now how do you clean it out of the air? They haven't figured that out yet.
Mm-hmm. There's so many issues with it. It sounds like it affects, you know, our air and our water and the ocean potentially and the safety of everybody along its path.
Mm-hmm. And, old growth forest.
And there's the earth itself.
Yeah, clearing the route for the pipeline is going to, you know, take a significant amount on either side for where the pipe is going to go. So that would be, you know, doing some more clear cutting through Oregon as well.
And they have to leave it clear, I think, for emergency purposes.
Yeah, maintenance or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So then wildlife in the forest, you know, has a hard time bridging that gap. It's a real problem.
Yeah, exactly. Those habitats might even be permanently severed.
It's really something that, you know, it seems like one of the things I always think about is how amazing technology has brought us to this place where we really have so many other options that we could be moving towards on the planet. And the idea of pushing these pipelines, so many of them too at once, all over the nation. And I'm not even really familiar with the rest of the world, but just this nation. It seems like we're moving towards something that really should be becoming obsolete. We should be going the other direction, away from those kinds of energy sources, since it seems like...
I know some people act like we're saying no more natural gas or oil now, and it's like, for the most part, people are fighting expansions of these things. We're not even talking about stopping. I mean, we need to do ramp down also, right? But at least we could stop expanding and stop using these extreme techniques like fracking and scraping the earth to do this tar sands thing. It's just so destructive. I want to check from back from when you talked about being out at Standing Rock, because I feel like there were so many qualities that introduced that were different from the kind of the usual, not that it's usual, it's always different, but the white dominant, you know, the white led, you know, activist scene and the native led, like new things were brought in, and one of them was the spirituality, which we talked about, you know, the whole first part of the show. So I'm wondering if, you know, spirituality or other things that you saw at Standing Rock, what do you think you will be able to bring from that to this struggle?
I think, you know, being at Standing Rock, it was really important for me to go and be a part of this, like, movement of centering Indigenous leadership, like Indigenous leadership of that place. Because for me, as an Indigenous person and someone who travels a lot through other Indigenous folks' territories, I've always been raised to respect, you know, that there are prayers and songs and language and ceremonies that have, you know, really been, I don't know, just that these things have a relationship with specific places. And with that are specific people who, you know, are looking out for the water and for the land and everything that's in those spaces. And that's all responsibility. And you know, just recognizing that, I think, is a huge principle of respect in being, you know, any sort of person walking on this continent. So to go to Standing Rock, which, you know, is a series of prayer camps, it was this huge moment, you know, of like real direct action happening, and this was all, you know, at its core being supported by the people of that place, the Standing Rock tribe. So yeah, I think what did I take from that is just that the strength of any movement is going to be the strength of honoring the local voices of wherever we are, because they are the most knowledgeable, like in the most historical sense and current and future sense. And just being able to see, you know, what kind of beautiful, powerful, direct resistance can happen when you have kind of, you know, unity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And I think that's a big... kind of topic that's happening now in the spaces that I'm a part of, for sure, and I'm sure everywhere. But I think, you know, what was successful at Standing Rock was when those local voices were being listened to and heard and followed. So, you know, anywhere along this pipeline route in Southern Oregon. I mentioned the Indigenous territories that the pipeline is going through. There are voices there. There are leaders there who have been there for, you know, as they say, since time immemorial. And those voices are, I think, the voices to listen to and to support and follow.
I think that's very true. A lot of times you don't pay attention to the people that have that experience already, and it's like, and people get in this mode where they're trying to reinvent a wheel when somebody's already there and has that established. So one of the main things that I think that is really important is to reiterate that there is a time period where people can communicate with
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So we know at the federal level it's pretty unlikely we'll get what we want, but, you know, for many people we believe that it's important to go through each of these steps. We'll probably have more luck at the state level. But right now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has to give permission for this thing to be built, they are taking input on what to pay attention to while they do their environmental review. So we can give comments. There's no deadline as far as I know, but it's really do it as soon as possible, because I don't even know if they've already begun their environmental review. Do you know?
I have the timeline now.
Okay.
But yes, they're asking for comments from the public because they're formulating the environmental impact statement. So the scoping meetings were in June. And a scoping meeting is when they go out and visit certain places that the project is going to directly impact. And I'm just looking at some notes that I have. And unfortunately, I don't have the cutoff date. But, you know, I've heard just dates like that it's coming up soon, like August 15th, I think, was the last date that I heard. But I think FERC was also saying that they, you know, will be accepting comments, I think, until early September. But it is important to get those comments in soon. And they want, I think they have the guidelines for those comments on their website. They want things specifically about the environment. But, you know, I think it's also important to stress, like, the social impacts that these projects have as well. Because we want to reach FERC, we want them to understand why this project is not a good idea for any of our communities here in Oregon.
Definitely. And then if you're a listener and you feel inspired and want to become more involved in other ways, what other ways would you suggest that people can do something to be involved with the issue?
Yeah, so I think it depends on where you're at. There are several grassroots organizations throughout Oregon, and a good way to get connected with those is to go to No LNG Exports, their website, which is www.nolngexports.org, and I think you'll have like the links for that.
I'll put that in the links on the KPW Facebook page, but yeah, that's the coalition of all, you know, or many of the groups that are fighting this.
And what kinds of things are they looking for help, you know, as far as if somebody was like, I want to plug in, what kind of ways do you think people can be helpful with the group?
Yeah, I think, you know, I, Adobal, think that a lot of people, what we're doing right now is we're all kind of playing catch up with this. This has been a very fast process this go around, whereas like in the past they might have dilly-dallied a little bit. But I think, you know, creating more local awareness wherever you are, like get people together and talk about it, talk about, you know, things that have happened in the past around this project. Maybe have a march or, you know, contact our Oregon senators. Maybe do some direct actions if you want to also bring awareness. Contacting, I'm just pulling up my notes. And also calling Governor Brown to encourage state agencies to use Oregon's highest environmental standards to deny permits for the project.
She has decision-making power on at least one of those, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, Governor Brown, you say a lot of really great, awesome, progressive things. However, you can't be for, like, you know, a pipeline that's shipping fracked gas and still be progressive at all.
It's very confusing.
Yeah. We're getting mixed signals, Governor. But yeah, so, you know, just staying local, creating lots of awareness, submitting comments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, FERC, as well as, you know, keeping an eye out or an ear out, being aware for when FERC may decide to or may not approve, give their okay for a permit, which I think is going to happen around November, in which case I think there will definitely be more apparent things to plug into. Because then, you know, this will be the first time that a permit will have been granted for a project, if that happens. But yeah, just stay local, generate lots of awareness, connect with Southern Oregon Rising Tide, Rogue Climate, No LNG Exports, and maybe, you know, do some local research about the indigenous territories that you're in and kind of start doing that work as well.
So are you ready for thousands of people to come camp out in Southern Oregon in the path of the pipeline?
I have some things to say about that. if you weren't at Standing Rock and if you didn't have any real sort of leadership responsibility, I really encourage you to think about how your presence would be impacting local communities, local indigenous communities with your presence there, because those camps are a lot of responsibility It takes a lot to bring that many people together. And I can tell you that unless an Indigenous community calls for that, then that's trespassing. You know, that isn't consent. Just because someone hasn't clearly given a yes or no, that doesn't mean that you should, you know, go and set up a camp. Yeah, just please be respectful, and like I was talking about, centering Indigenous voices and listening to them, be mindful and double think about how helpful your presence would be there, and wait until it's asked for.
For sure. Thank you so much, Ada and Hafez and John. And this has been Water is Life. We thank you for listening, and we look forward to sharing more next month.
On the surface of the water, I see my reflection, but that's only the outside. I'm living here in this body, but it takes more than I the inside. I've got blood flowing through me like a river, and my skin is just like the bark of a tree. There's so much more than what you look at if you close your eyes, you might see. Look beneath the surface of the water. There's many creatures living there. Look beneath the surface of the water, we'll find the wisdom of the earth there. There are deer standing over yonder, as a black crow flies on by. And me, I'm just standing here singing my heart song and learning what it means to cry. I've got blood flowing through me like a river, and my skin is just like the bark of a tree. There's so much more than what we look at if we close our eyes, we might see. Look beneath the surface of the water. There's many creatures living there. Look beneath the surface of the water. We'll find the wisdom of the earth there. Thank you. many creatures living there. Look beneath the surface of the water. We'll find the wisdom of the earth there. We'll find the wisdom of the earth there.